The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be the king." But Samuel said, "How can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me." The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' Invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what to do. You are to anoint the one I indicate." Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They asked, "Do you come in peace?" Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass in front of Saul. But Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." Jesse then made Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, "Nor has the Lord chosen this one." Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." So he asked Jesse, "Are these all your sons you have?" "There is still the youngest," Jesse answered, "but he is tending sheep." Samuel said, "Send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives." So he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy, with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. He is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. Saul's attendants said to him, "See, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord command his servants here to search for someone who can play the harp. He will play when the evil spirit from God comes upon you, and you will feel better." So Saul said to his attendants, "Find someone who plays well and bring him in to me." One of the servants answered, "I have seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He is a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man, and the Lord is with him." Then Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the sheep." So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat, and sent them with his son David to Saul. David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. Then Saul sent word to Jesse, saying, "Allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him." Whenever the Spirit from God came upon Saul, David would take his harp and play. Then relief would come to Saul. He would feel better, and the evil spirit would leave him.
What choices have you made that surprised others? Or what choices have others made, be it family members or friends, that have surprised you? Some choices matter, others really don't. So whether someone chooses a red or a blue or a garishly bright green car doesn't matter, but if someone chooses for you who you'll marry, as some cultures do, that matters. Some choices have profound impact on our lives, whilst others don't. When I was 13, my parents chose to send me to boarding school. That was a surprise to me. It was a surprise to many others. It was a surprise to my grandparents and to our family friends. We knew no one who had sent their child to a boarding school. No one in my family had ever been. No one in our church was attending a boarding school. It was a surprising choice. It was a surprising choice that had a real impact on my life. And at first, I thought it was a negative impact being sent away from home. But after a while, I began to realize that actually was a sacrificial choice on the part of my parents, but it was also a choice that they made that had a real impact on my life for good. Some choices matter and are quite profound. Other choices aren't. And in 1 Samuel 16, God makes a surprising choice that matters greatly for his people then and matters greatly for his people today. It was a choice that had real implications, not just for one life, but for many lives. And so we see in verses 1 to 12 that the Lord provides a king after his own heart. The Lord provides a king after his own heart. Verse 1, we read Samuel is mourning for the loss of Saul as king. For Samuel, it felt like a grey day in January with the rain falling, the temperature a few degrees above freezing, with nothing to seemingly look forward to. Samuel was saddened. He was saddened over Saul's rebellion and rejection. He was saddened over an ended kingship that had begun with such promise. Doubtless he'd had personal affection for Saul as well. But Samuel's grief went beyond mourning for Saul and his failed kingship. Samuel was presumably fearing that Israel would disintegrate with Saul's sin and rejection, that God's people might now self-destruct. I mean, they could all remember the days before Saul's kingship. They could remember the days of the judges, the days of Eli and his sons. What would happen now? Would Israel's enemies take advantage? But as he grieves, the Lord comes to him, verse 1, how long will you mourn for Saul? Since I have rejected him as king over Israel. No, fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse at Bethlehem. I have chosen, or literally, I have seen one of his sons to be king. Here is God's answer to Samuel's mourning. I have provided myself with a new king. I'm going to provide new leadership. I have not let go of my people. And this idea of God providing runs throughout the chapter. Do you see the word translated chosen in verse 1? The end of verse 1 there. It's literally the word seen. I have seen among his sons a king. Now why is that important? Well, because the root word from which the verb I have seen in Hebrew comes from is the word ra, which carries with it the sense of provision, to provide. This root word, to provide, then occurs 9 times in this chapter. Now, it's not readily visible in an English translation, but it appears in verse 1 and verse 17 as provided in the ESV, or as chosen and find, verse 17, in the NIV. And then it's as of translated as a verb, as to see or look in verse 6, 3 times look in verse 7, and then again in verse 18. Then this same root is translated as a noun of meaning appearance in verse 7 and verse 12. So each of these words, chosen, find, see, look, appearance, in the Hebrew, derives from this root word to provide. And the point is that through this chapter, it is the Lord that provides. It's the Lord that will provide for his people through his choices. And in providing, he's demonstrating his love, he's demonstrating his care, he's demonstrating his concern for his people. Just as I, as a father, a husband, provide for my family, my children. And as I do it, it demonstrates my love for them. It demonstrates my care for them. And at times, it demonstrates my generosity to them. And similarly with God. His provision demonstrates his care and his concern and his generosity for his people in the midst of potential spiritual disaster from Saul. And how's he going to provide? By giving them a king after his own heart. Just as he promised he would in chapter 13, verse 14. And so God sends Samuel to Bethlehem. And Samuel is a little fearful. What if Saul hears? What if Saul hears that I'm off anointing another king? He'll kill me. And so the Lord graciously gives Samuel an additional task to do. He's to take a heifer, verse 2, with him and say, I've come to sacrifice. And invite Jesse to that sacrifice. And whilst you're there sacrificing, anoint for me the one that I'll indicate. Now note, Samuel is going not knowing which son is chosen. He's in the dark. It's the first time God's prophet goes not knowing the full picture, as it were. But such is his obedience. So we're just pausing there, isn't it? He doesn't know the full picture, but he obeys. We often don't know the full picture, but we're to obey. Samuel goes, and he arrives. And the elders of Bethlehem, verse 4, tremble with fear. Samuel the prophet is turning up at their village. Had someone done something wrong? Had Samuel gotten wind of some injustice, some wickedness going on in the community? Was this a disciplinary visit? Or maybe it was a political visit? I mean, folks in Bethlehem, even though they were out in the country, they still listened to the news. They knew of the big falling out between Samuel and Saul. If they receive Samuel, will Saul punish them? So fearfully they asked, Samuel, do you come in peace? Yes, Samuel replies, I come in peace. I've come to sacrifice. And to those elders, a heifer had never looked so good. And so Samuel instructs the elders to consecrate, to purify themselves. And whilst the elders are consecrating themselves, Samuel consecrates Jesse and his sons and invites them to the sacrifice, verse 5. And as they arrive, Samuel sees Eliab. And Eliab looks impressive. And Samuel immediately thinks, verse 6, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. Surely this is the one. And presumably Eliab looked impressive. I mean, doubtless he was an impressive hunk of manhood. You know, he was 6'2". He was muscular. He was toned. He was ripped even. And on top of that, he met people well. He was all man, but with social grace. He had excellent taste in clothing. His aftershave lotion was excellent. He was probably the star of school, you know, playing on the first team for football and rugby and cricket, as well as excelling academically, exceptionally. He was the classic all-rounder. He was the kind of guy you want to hate, but he was just so nice, you couldn't. And Samuel's mesmerized by this man. Maybe we're mesmerized by such a man. But the Lord is not. Verse 7, he can see clearly. Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Oh, we've all done what Samuel did. Impressions based on what we've seen. Years ago on the camp we serve on in the summer, there was a young man who came as a junior leader. And he became known as a bit of a rebel. Now, let me get this right. Rebel in terms of Christian camp rebel, not in terms of worldly rebel. You know, so he broke the 11 p.m. bedtime curfew. And he encouraged other junior leaders to do the same, so that the junior leader boys and girls went out and met in the field under the big tree, I mean the big taboo on a Christian camp. And this guy would ride motorbikes up and down the 1 mile drive in the middle of the night through the cows with his mates trying to make them moo. And he would start water fights in the scullery when they should be washing up. This guy was a rebel in terms of camp world. And so when camp ended And the overseeing site team were assessing whether to invite him back. This guy was not on the list, unsurprisingly. In fact, most of them thought he should go and never come back. But for one old wise pastor who had met with him and been his Bible study leader that week, he had seen something in him and encouraged the oversight team to have him back. And not just as a junior leader, but as a leader, much to their surprise. Well, in God's grace, they followed his advice, and this young man came back. After a number of years, he became one of the overall leaders on that camp. Not only that, he became a pastor and a preacher and a church leader, and still is today by God's grace. That wise old pastor had seen past the outward appearance. He'd seen a glimpse of God's grace at work in that young man's heart. That the team had misjudged the heart. They'd just seen the outward, but not this wise old pastor. Not dear Jonathan, for which I am grateful. Samuel had misjudged the heart. He had gone on outward appearance. God does not misjudge the heart, nor does he go on an outward appearance. God looks at the heart. He's looking for one after his own heart. Which does not mean a sinless heart, but a submissive heart. A heart that is willing and wanting to follow God's ways. A heart that is fundamentally set on God's kingdom. And his purposes, even if at times this king will get it wrong. Now, God is not looking at his heart and choosing and electing him for salvation. God is looking at his heart to appoint him to an office, to a role. That's not to say that the Bible does not teach election and God's choice in salvation, but that's not what is happening here. God is looking at the heart, and he's appointing to office, to a role, to a particular job, and he appoints not on competency, but on character. Not on giftedness, but on the heart. Which means his choice is often surprising, because it's often not the one we would choose. It's not the outwardly impressive. So Eliab's rejected, and Abinadab's rejected, and Shammah's rejected, and four other brothers are rejected, and there are seemingly none left. And Samuel's beginning to sweat. Had he got it wrong? Are there any more, Jesse? Well, there's the youngest, but he's out tending the sheep. Don't know why he's from Somerset, but why not? See, presumably Jesse did not invite him because he thought he would not be needed. I mean, so obscure is this youngest son. We're not even told his name. I mean, he's the youngest. He's tending sheep. But Samuel immediately says, fetch him. We will not start until he arrives. And so the youngest arrives. And verse 12, he was ruddy with a fine appearance and handsome features. Don't you hate it when you read a Bible verse and it just describes you? And immediately the Lord says, rise and anoint him. He's the one. And that verse 12 knocks on the head that kind of God opposes fine appearance, as if ugliness or repulsiveness constitute the key of God's call. No, that's not the point. The point is, external appearance neither qualifies nor disqualifies. It simply doesn't matter. See, for Israel's good, the Lord looks at the heart. He provides a king after his own heart, a king who would submit to his rule and his ways, a king who would delight in him. That is what Israel needed. A good father gives you what you need, not what you desire. And God is good. And so God provides a king after his own heart, not a king who looked humanly impressive. And when God provides a king for us, David's great-great-grandson, see how important that choice of God's now in David is. But when God provides a king for us, he provided one who is not humanly impressive. Isaiah writes that Jesus had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. In fact, he was despised and rejected by men. Mark records that people saw him as just one of us. Others complained he was too much fun. Others objected he's not from the right place. Others said, hey, the Messiah would not and does not suffer. They rejected him. They despised him. He didn't fit their profile. He was not outwardly impressive. But his heart was perfectly after God's heart. It was perfectly submissive. It was sinless. He was the perfect king. And yet how? How, if we had our way, we would have chosen one, oh, so brave and mighty and popular. And yet God provides not what we think we need, but what he knows we need. And God provides and chooses the perfect king whose heart is like his. And we should delight in God's choice, in his provision for us. We should delight in his unusual, unguessable ways. It honors him when we delight and rejoice and revel in his surprising provision and in providing such a king, the right king. And God demonstrates his great love for us in providing such a king. He demonstrates his supreme care for us. He demonstrates his overwhelming generosity in giving his perfect son to be our king and die for us. We'd have never have chosen such a king if it was down to us. We'd have never looked to one like Jesus if it was down to us. We'd have never chosen him to be a king. Man despised and rejected him. And this passage should serve as a warning to us, because all too often we choose leaders who seem outwardly impressive. We see their gifting and think they must be the one. And we hold them in awe because of their competency or their popularity or their seemingly outward charm. Or their amazing giftedness, and we fail to look at their character. And it's striking that as Paul teaches and speaks of elders in 1 Timothy 3, he only mentions one area of competency, able to teach, able to instruct and teach doctrine. Everything else that he lists about the qualities of an elder are all about character, are all about heart. Are all about living out the Christian faith. It's not about the most gifted. It's about being godly and having a heart that is submitting to Christ. God looks at the heart. And if the character is right, God can provide the competency. He can provide the giftedness. Often the best leaders, be it elders or youth, or children's workers, or women leaders, or Bible study leaders. The best leaders in churches are not the most humanly impressive, but they're always the godliest. They are those who have hearts after God. I have a friend who I have to confess I wrote off. I could never see him as a pastor. He was if I can say, and I won't mention his name in case he ever listens, he was a bit wet. I kind of called him a nan-like kind of character. Acted more like my grandma, is what it means. He looked completely wimpish and weak, and outwardly in all ways he looked unimpressive. But he loves Jesus. He loves people. He can preach. He has one of the biggest pastoral hearts of anyone I know. He is godly, and he hits every one of Paul's criteria in 1 Timothy 3. And on top of that, he is theologically sharp. He's exactly what you want as a pastor. And if we're following God's wisdom and we're trusting God to provide, his choices may be surprising in our eyes, but it will be what we need. God provides a king after his own heart. Secondly, the Lord provides his king with his spirit, verses 13 to 23. Lord provides his king with his spirit. See verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed David in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Now, it's worth saying that at this point, he's not anointed as king per se. That anointment comes in 2 Samuel 2:4, where he's anointed as king over Judah, and then in 2 Samuel 5, verse 3, where he's anointed as king over Israel and Judah, over the whole lot, as it were. But for now, he's anointed as one set aside to be king. He's set aside as one who will be the king. But that does not mean he's not to be equipped. See, for not only does God choose David for kingship, he now equips him for the work. Not only does God appoint his servants to a task, but at the same time, he gives them what he needs to fulfill that task. And of course, the same is true today, that when God appoints someone to serve, he grants them what is needed to that role. It's why we can be confident that if we choose leaders based on character, God will give them what they need to do the work. He'll give them the skills and the competency. He'll give them the tools to do the job, as it were. They'll have the Spirit of God at work in them. And we're given a glimpse in verses 14 to 23 of how God has equipped David. And it starts by giving us a contrast between the two kings. See, verse 13, the Spirit is on God. Verse 14, the Spirit has departed from Saul, and Saul is now troubled by an evil spirit instead. And this evil spirit is from God. It's not a demon. It's not the Holy Spirit, but a spirit from God that has been sent to torment. Think of like the angel of death scenario. In other words, the writer wants us to see that this is all part of God's purposes. And such is the torment that Saul cannot even diagnose the problem. It requires his attendance, verse 15, to diagnose and suggest the treatment of someone to play harp. Saul responds, verse 17, find me someone who plays well and bring him to me. And one of the servants answers, verse 18, I've seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He's a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man. And here's the key. And the Lord is with him. And so Saul sends messengers to Jesse to have David sent. And David comes and enters the service of Saul. And of course you have great irony here. Because here you have the rejected king choosing the chosen king. And he does so using the same words, find and see, as God has done in choosing David. It's as if the writer wants us to think David has been doubly chosen. He's been chosen by God, and now he's been chosen by the current rejected king. Clearly, David is God's man. But the writer also wants us to see that David is indeed equipped with God's Spirit, that he's going to be equipped for the troubles ahead, of which we begin to get a sample of. It's only David who can calm and soothe Saul, verse 23. Only David can bring comfort. And presumably it's only because David has the Spirit. Because the harp in itself has no power to comfort. But the man filled with the Spirit of God does have power, verse 13. The Spirit-filled man is able to bring comfort to this rejected man. Troubled man. And verses 21 to 23 kind of give us a summary of what is to come. Saul starts off loving David, but it will soon turn to hatred because of this evil spirit within him. And David, filled with the Spirit, will remain loyal to Saul in spite of Saul's hatred. Because David has God's Spirit. David has been equipped. God has provided for his king through his Spirit. And you see God providing in exactly the same way for Jesus. It's striking, isn't it? Jesus ministers and goes to the cross because he's filled with God's Spirit. It's why we see the dove descend upon him at his baptism. It's why Luke records in chapter 4, verse 14, that Jesus, in the power of the Spirit, began his ministry. Jesus serves in the power of the Spirit. God has provided for his king, Jesus, just as he provided for his king, David. And of course, it's not then a surprise that Jesus then commands his disciples in Acts 1 to wait for the Spirit. And only once the Spirit comes upon them, Acts 2, are they able to go out and minister and serve and preach. The king, again, provides for his people the Spirit. Because the point is, you can't serve without the Spirit. David is called and he's equipped. Jesus is called and he's equipped. And the disciples and the apostles are called and they're equipped. And we who follow Jesus, called to serve, may not be God's anointed, but we're called to serve and we're equipped with the Spirit. And yet how easy it is for us to think that somehow we can minister or serve in our own strength, that somehow we can do all these things without the Spirit. As if we're somehow better and stronger and more sufficient than David or Jesus or the apostles. So the question is, are you dependent on the Spirit as you serve, as you live out your life as a believer? Is it evident by your prayers or your concerns? And the ministry that we're called to is similar in some ways to David. David's here in verses 14 to 23. You see, this picture of the Spirit-filled man comforting the rejected is a picture for us to follow. Saul will hate David, yet he's sustained by David's service. Because it's David who will bring comfort, restraining evil, restraining that evil spirit. And David's able to do so because he's filled with the Spirit. The world hates Christ's people. Yet in its doomed state, it's only benefited by them. Like Saul is benefited by David and yet hates him. The world hates us and yet is benefited by us. We're the ones who are the salt of the earth. That is keeping the world from being worse than it is. We're a divinely granted restraint upon the earth's sin. And we've all experienced that when hanging with non-Christians, how our very presence curbs their language and their behaviour. Somehow they feel they can't speak about certain subjects or view certain internet sites in our presence. When I was a sales rep many years ago, at my first sales meeting, with all the reps and the managing director and the finance director and everyone's there, we'd all gone out for dinner, and I end up sitting next to the managing director. I'm 24, I'm nervous, my first meal like this, I really don't know these guys, I've only been at the company for 6 months, and I'm chatting with the managing director. And he turns to me and he says, Mark, he says, I know you're a Christian. He says, I know you go to church, I know that you take your faith seriously. And Mark, if there's anything we do as a sales team that offends your faith, you let me know and we'll stop it. Now that was not of me. That was all of God prompting this MD who sat next to a Spirit-filled, nervous, hesitating Christian. But God uses that situation to begin to bring a restraint on the behavior of a sales team. In that sense, we're kind of restraining sin. And it's not that Christians have all the answers, but a world without Christians in it would be far worse. And like David bringing comfort to Saul's troubled hearts, as we proclaim the kingdom, as we witness, as we're beacons of light, we bring comfort to troubled hearts. Because the only true comfort is not from a heart, but from God's Spirit at work through the gospel in people's lives. As those filled with God's Spirit, we have a responsibility to reach out, to bring comfort and to, in some sense, restrain evil. And it's humbling to hear that. To think that we have such a responsibility. See, being a Christian is not about just having a private individual relationship with God. We do. Being a Christian is about serving, about being an influence on the world around us, on the small part of the world where we have been placed. Because we follow a king who has called us and equipped us to serve. God equips his people for his works. God provides for his people. God equips his people. Are you willing to be used just like David was willing to be used?